Boy, she said, Doe, she won't stand out there trying to unlock that door and all that pouring down rain. And I realized it too, and I knew we'd get wet.
I don't think it rained after all, though, did it?
But I said that
could leak.
Huh?
Who do you suggest?
Nobody. We don't have anyone. That's what's the matter.
What
we don't have anyone. Oh, the preacher's wife could do it, but she's got to take a back seat.
Well, of course she wasn't there last night.
I say she could do it, but she won't do it.
No, sir. She sings real sweet.
I reckon she can. I guess she gets enough of it, sir. Did Coca tell you about calling Don yesterday?
No.
Which they called Don and Mr. Cook was there for supper last night.
Oh,
Ed's there,
huh?
Uh-huh.
How nice.
Yeah. You know, they invited him up to the church that Sunday.
Uh-huh.
To come one night and have supper with them while he was up there.
Yeah.
So when they called Don, Don says, guess who's him?
Oh.
And they said they didn't know, and he said, Mr. Cook's going to have supper with us.
Well, did Cora call him?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, wasn't that nice that they could have him?
Yeah, well, when they left, they said that they hoped he would come, said they would have him whatever night that he could come, you know.
I know he appreciated them asking him, because he's kind of lonely up there.
Because I tell you, Jane's a fine person.
Well, I'm so glad they asked him because I know he's lonely.
Yeah, and, of course, they didn't talk too long, you know. She said that they just wanted to call him and talk to him, so before they went to church, they called. J.B. would just give out. You know what they done out there at that lake yesterday, I think. Sam Ward and son, June's husband and son, I think all of them must give out. You know, they put up a dock. They put up a dock, and I declare it's about the nicest thing that you ever saw. And I'll tell you that J.B., he liked to got too hot, I think. We come back by the lake and stopped over there with him a while, but
well,
I tell you that
job.
J.B. was about shot.
I said, that was quite a job.
Oh, that was a job, and that fella Harry that lives in Coker's house, he was going to help him, but his partner's father died or something other, and he had to go to Miami. But he loaned them the thing, whatever that thing is, that looked like a hose to me. I don't know what it was. It pumps water out of the hose, you know, so you can get your post in.
I've asked them one of how they did that.
Well, he loaned them one of them things. He had one. And boy, they got them big old stabbers post down and fixed. It's a wonderful thing. It's longest one I ever saw.
I wondered how you handled that.
That's right. It's the longest one I ever saw. And did you talk about a kid? June Jones was all out there.
Was it very deep when they put the last one down?
I don't know.
Oh, you didn't.
But I tell you, they had a time diving off of that thing.
They really enjoy that.
Yeah, they're going to enjoy that.
Well, I imagine Gloria enjoys fishing off of it.
Yes, she will. I will, too. I told him I could fish now. I never been able to fish before, because I didn't have nowhere to sit down and couldn't reach out there, you know. But it'll go right to that little grass hole over there. Somebody ought to catch some nice fish.
I said, you can take your can and go fish.
But, you know, I can't see too good out in the bright sun no more. It worries my eye and worries me, too.
You can't wear sunglasses over your glasses.
Well, I do that, too. I had them on all day yesterday, but it still kind of, you know.
You can't wear a big hat, too?
It kind of upsets me.
Oh, it does. Well, I just wouldn't do it.
Well, when a cloudy day comes, I might be. Now, you know, I haven't been fishing but one time since I had my eye operated on it.
Oh,
I thought, my boss. I believe it's going to put it out, but Carl says, I see no reason why you can't go fishing. I said, huh? I said, you don't. I wonder if you have any idea what a difference it is to get out there on that lake.
And I wonder if a bonnet would be better.
Huh?
A bonnet.
I ain't going to wear no bonnet.
Huh?
I ain't going to wear no bonnet.
I bet you it would protect you.
I ain't going to wear none, no. I don't want no bonnet.
Oh, don't be so high-minded.
I tell you, I could wear one of them little caps like Tommy had with that green bib on it, you know, that come down in front. I imagine that'd be a lot of help.
Well, you can get a visor without the cap.
Yeah, well, I'm not even willing to get out there. They can catch a fish.
Well,
you know, Lynn caught three bass one day herself.
Uh-huh. I think I should come first, so if it bothers you.
Listen, how's Joel doing?
Man.
How's Joel doing?
It ain't this, little old dog was some sick.
He wasn't?
Saturday, he didn't come down all morning. So after dinner, I was going up when it got cooler to see about him. You know, he always stays at my house.
I know it.
And so I said something to Elizabeth that as soon as it got a little cooler, I was going up to see about him. And she said, I'll go. And when she went up there, he followed her back.
Oh, he did?
Uh-huh. And he didn't seem very lively. And I put him in on my porch.
Can he walk?
Huh?
Can he walk?
He was limping. And I put him in on the porch, Frank did. And when he picked him up, he sort of cried.
Well, he was just so, I guess.
And so I put him on the porch. I gave him some dog food. He wouldn't eat it. So I gave him two pieces of chicken, a chicken wing and a piece of bread. And he didn't eat it right at first, but a little later I left him alone. He ate that. And then I had some iced potatoes. I had fried a little too brown. We couldn't eat. And some shrimp tails.
Mm-hmm.
I had fried. Well, so I put them out there on a paper. Do you know he picked out every shrimp tail and left the potatoes? He picked them out, and they were all together, and he picked out one after another out of the potatoes, separated them.
Well, I declare.
And I said, Frank, you wouldn't eat those two brown of potatoes either. And I said he ate every shrimp tail.
Well, I declare.
And I think there must have been about two dozen.
Is he up there this morning? Is he with you this morning?
Well, I haven't been out. He was out there early this morning.
He's probably out there because Lynn had to go. Lynn went to Bible school this morning.
And I tried to feed him dog food and he wouldn't touch it.
He don't like that dog food too much in the first place.
And I got a can I just opened. I picked up the food after he wouldn't eat it. It's open and I thought I'd take it to Gloria later. Then I have two full cans. Well, Frank said he'll eat what he wants and you can't make him eat.
Well, that's right. He's never been a big eater, Iris.
But he's tired of it. He ate one can of food. He came back yesterday morning hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out back to the door and he was frisky. Came up to the door and he bumped the door to let me know.
Well, I said maybe to do him good.
He bumped the door, you know, was closed, and I was done. I said, well, hello. I'm glad you let me know you're here. Are you hungry? And he wiggled his tail. See, I went out there, and he wanted me to love him a little bit first. And then I put down half a can of food, and he sailed right in.
Oh, he did?
And ate that in a little bit. I said, Frank, I believe you eat a little more. I had a little bit more. He'd eaten a little. And I gave him that and he cleaned it up. And so he was feeling better. But he just ate a spoonful of it Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
But he loved the chicken and shrimp. He'd rather have that. But he never would eat those potatoes. Frank said he had enough to eat with the chicken.
I reckon I better let you go. Somebody might want to phone.
If he wasn't a favorite dog, I wouldn't be feeding him chicken.
Well, he sure does love y'all anyway.
Yeah, well, ain't nice he stayed on the porch just as contented. I threw an old rug out there. He must have stayed out there 4 or 5 hours. And then he told me he had to go out, and I let him out.
Well, I declare.
He spent the night at home. But I still think he must be hurt a little bit.
He's probably hurt. I guess he is. He's hurt pretty bad, I expect.
Well,
you know Bunk. Don't you know how sore he could be?
Well, you don't want to mess him with his leg because he kind of snapped at me when I wanted to examine him.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, leave it alone. Well, I'm glad you're home.
Yeah, I'm glad to be home. I'll see you here.
Okay.
Bye.
Apollo 15 trip to the moon and back cost in all about $445 million. When you look at it that way, it's a pretty expensive undertaking. But when you look at it another way, it doesn't sound quite that formidable. This trip cost an individual taxpayer $4.20. I'll have some thoughts about the costs of the space program in a minute. Since the Apollo program was started early in the 1960s, the United States' effort to put men on the moon has cost us about $25 billion. That's a lot of money, $25 billion. That's more than enough money, for example, to clean up the disgraceful situations in all of our courts and all of our jails, which would go a long way toward bringing the crime rate down to an acceptable level. $25 billion was what we spent on the Vietnam War every year when we were building up our forces there. $25 billion is more than we spent, far more than we spent on the Marshall Plan program, which rebuilt Western Europe after the Second World War. $25 billion, as the president might say, is a heck of a lot of money. And it is quite understandable that many of the politicians who are honestly agonized about crime or the cities or hunger say that we should spend that kind of money here at home, cleaning up our own house before we go journeying off into space. But let's look at it from another point of view. There have been four manned visits to the moon so far. The cost of the first one was, to each individual federal taxpayer, $3.60. The cost of the present extended mission to the moon is, to each taxpayer, $4.20. What with inflation, each of us will probably end up paying about $5 for Apollo 17, which will be the last of the manned trips to the moon. We will make no more after that because it's become too expensive. But is it too expensive? If you were asked to lay out an extra $10 on your income tax every year just for the space program, would you do it? Many people would. The average family income in the United States today is around $9,000. $5 or $10 a year doesn't seem excessive. A lot of people say they would add a dollar to their income tax to finance political campaigns to get them out of the hands of the fat cats. And there are other programs involving some desperately needed social reforms for which many of us would shell out something extra each April. The point is that the people of the United States are rich enough to pay for a reasonable space program and at the same time solve many of their problems at home. What is lacking is a politician brave enough to say we ought to pay more taxes, whether they be local, state, or federal. But none of our leaders will say that. A society defines itself by how it spends its money. We are defining ourselves by not spending enough to solve our problems on this planet and closing down the space program as well. John Chancellor, NBC News, New York.
To get the railroad unions to change their work rules, but then it's difficult to change anything. Back in the railroad strike, there may be something to be learned by all of us who believe this country is desperately in need of change. And what might be learned is it is desperately hard to do, because in every individual there is some resistance to change, often even when it's for the better. The railroad strike was not about money. They'd already agreed on an increase of 42%. The strike was about the union work rules. They are an accumulation of agreements dating back to the 19th century, and over the years, one rule has piled on top of another. They now run to hundreds of pages of fine print, and both the railroads and the unions agree that if they were ever strictly enforced, no train could ever move. One railroad worker we know of, when he goes to work, packs his lunch and a copy of the work rules. He winds up carrying more rules than lunch because they come in two books weighing 3 pounds. The most troublesome one is that moving a train 100 miles is a day's work, even if it only takes 2 or 3 hours. Well, that rule was made in the days of steam locomotives when 100 miles took about 8 hours. They had to keep stopping for water and coal and so on. And then diesel and electric locomotives came along and began making 100 miles in 2 to 3 hours. But the work rule remained, because in those days the railroads were making money and it was easier just to let it slide. And over the years, settlements and towns grew up every 100 miles along the tracks, called division points, where the trains change crews. Crew members settle down in these division points, bought houses, put their children in school, and arrange their lives around that rule. It was so firmly fixed that when the Penn Central put in high-speed trains between New York and Washington, Metroliners, making 225 miles in 3 hours, they didn't want to slow down the trains for crew changes, and so they made a deal with the union. One crew takes the train the whole distance, 225 miles, 3 hours, but had to be paid for 2.5 days' work. Well, this had become a way of life for railroad people, a day's pay for 100 miles. And lately, when the railroads began going broke and wanted to change the rule, they bitterly refused. They just simply didn't want to change their living habits, even with a pay increase. Well, that kind of resistance to change is true in unions and true outside of unions. It is true in Congress, and it's true in all of the federal establishment and much of American life. So, those who want to make changes will just have to be willing to wait. David Brinkley, NBC News, Washington.
11534.
11534.
The little doctor. Hi, this is Dorme Henderson. I'm calling for Mrs. March Live and Good.
Who?
Mrs. March Live and Good.
Yes.
And she has a real bad headache and vomiting, and I was wondering if I could bring her in and get her a shot.
Hey, bring her on in.
Okay, will she have to wait too long?
I don't know. The nurses are here. They can give it to her, I guess.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
The Steelworkers Union has won a hefty increase in pay totaling 30% over the next 3 years. The steel industry is raising prices an average of 8%, which on top of earlier increases means an overall boost of 15% in 1971. These developments obviously are a severe blow to the battle against inflation and undoubtedly will make it more difficult to slow down the rise in wages and prices. The White House has steadfastly resisted any kind of wage and price controls. But at the Capitol, Republicans as well as Democrats are now calling on the administration to take new steps. Some further comments in a moment. Paul Duke. A new term is being used these days to describe the economy. It's stagflation, meaning we have a stagnant economy, one with considerable unemployment and lagging business, but also one with persistent inflation. Inflation was well underway when President Nixon came into office in 1969. He has tried to stop it, but nothing has seemed to work. So we have the unions demanding and getting big pay increases and industry continuing to raise prices. What happened in the steel negotiations only underlines the problem. The industry already is in serious trouble, and the new contract seems certain to make matters worse. It promises to be more difficult for steel to pull out of its long slump. Thousands of workers may never benefit from their pay raises because they may be laid off. Some furnaces that were banked in preparation for a strike may never be fired up again. And new pressure is certain to build up from other industries eager to buy lower-priced steel products from other countries. The big increases given workers in steel and other major industries serve to distort the economy because the settlements far exceed the average cost of living increase for Americans as a whole. In other words, the settlements are about twice as inflationary as the economy taken as a whole, thus ensuring continuation of the inflationary spiral. The president has repeatedly made it plain he does not like to interfere with the collective bargaining process. But some Republicans, who now fear a political backlash in next year's elections, believe the White House must adopt new tactics. For this reason, a group of moderate and liberal Republican senators will introduce tomorrow bills that would compel the administration to make a greater attack against inflation. Their principal weapon would be the establishment of a federal wage and price board to lay down guidelines for new contracts. But more than anything, the action by these GOP senators will be a signal to the White House that Republicans are increasingly disenchanted with the administration's policies, that stagflation is intolerable at current levels, that unless it is overcome, 1972 may be a very bad year for Republicans. Paul Duke, NBC News, Washington.
Brinkley.
Ronald Ellums is a new congressman from California, interesting to contemplate. because he is in so many ways so different from the other members. He's from the 7th District, that's in the San Francisco area, and it includes Berkeley, perhaps one of the few districts in this country where he could get elected. He is black, which is not very unusual, and a social worker, which is. The average member is a lawyer. Lawyers tend to start in politics by involving themselves in local affairs, expanding their law practices in the process, running for local office and then state office and finally Congress. Dellums started with the Berkeley City Council and came directly from there to Congress, and he busied himself otherwise with psychiatric social work, organizations working in youth employment, social planning, and some college lecturing. People like him generally don't get far in politics. They may have no taste for it, or the voters may have no taste for them. But for whatever reason, Congress, every election, fills up with lawyers, plus a scattering of businessmen and an occasional farmer or teacher, a doctor or two, and now one Roman Catholic priest. Most of them dress soberly. Dellums in the latest hip mod fashion. Most of them keep quiet their first terms. He does not. Most of them never criticize in personal terms the other members, and they never criticize the House itself. Well, Dellums does all of that. This past weekend, for example, he said he was astonished to find the House full of mediocrities, men concerned mainly with their own petty interests. And as he put it, in the language never heard in Congress, most of them do nothing but collect a $42,000 welfare check. That's their annual salary. For generations, the House has been an easy, comfortable club, for the most part dominated by men who were or who called themselves country boys, slow and conservative in other ways, even when they were not so conservative politically, and more or less bound by the old unwritten rule, if you want to get along, go along. That is, if you want good committee assignments, you want your bills passed, dams and highways built in your district with federal tax money, go along. Don't say anything ugly. Don't antagonize the big mules who run the place, the leaders and committee chairmen. And you certainly don't go around making public speeches saying most of the members are mediocrities collecting welfare checks. Well, Dellums is breaking all these rules. But he is only one member out of 435, most of whom are lawyers who call themselves country boys, and if he hopes to change them, he needs a lot of help. David Brinkley, NBC News, Washington.
Daily report on the people and events. John Chancellor, Paul Duke, NBC News.
The president is willing to think about controls to stop inflation. He recalls wage and price controls in the past were a mess, and they were. But that was a different time. Back in a minute. The new increases in wages and prices guarantee more of the inflation, of which we already have too much. And there is hardly anyone, rich or poor, Republican or Democrat, who does not believe now that something must be done. Now, in particular, because nearly all the big unions, automobiles, railroads, steel, aluminum, and so on, have got their big pay increases. And presumably for a while, most contracts run 3 years, there'll be a relative peace in this field, some time in which to do something. Mr. Nixon, as we know, has said a dozen times he is against wage and price control as we had it in the past. It means a tremendous bureaucracy, tons of paper, interference in every area of private life, unfairness, black market, cheating. Fortunes were made in the black markets in World War II, and nobody wants to see all that again. Treasury Secretary Connally now says if Congress can figure out a way to do it, the president is willing to consider some kind of control. He again makes the point that it's very difficult. There are such questions as how to control rent, interest, taxes, and so on. But it seems to me, without having made a thorough study of it, that Mr. Nixon's doubts about the controls in World War II do not altogether apply now. Because then we had controls in the midst of a tremendous global war. There were black markets in meats, gasoline, nylons, housing, automobile tires, and many other things. But maybe not so much because of price control, but because all those things were scarce. None of them is scarce now. We have all we can use and more. Manpower was scarce then. Raw materials, transportation, all scarce then and plentiful now. So it would seem most of the trouble with wage and price control then would not exist now. If, however, they don't want to go into full-scale control of every price and every wage, some have suggested a wage stabilization board with legal power. The power to say simply that wages in this or that industry may not be raised more than a set percentage, no more than the percentage of increase in productivity. That would mean there would be no need and no excuse for anyone to raise his prices. Anyone doing so could be singled out by the board and publicized as being guilty of an unpatriotic act, gouging. No company could stand that. And it would be far simpler and easier than trying to dictate every nickel and dime in every price. If they want to stop inflation, there's an idea worth some attention. David Brinkley, NBC News, Washington.
She says, I hope men's going to be hungry. When she come in, she said, no, I'm not hungry. But boy, when she sit down there, she eat a plate full of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, she had to call Cora's this morning. I said, well, then you'll wake Don in there.
Well, that's all right.
But she had to call there. I said, well, tell Coca not to wake him up. But Coca did. Talk to him.
Well, I expect Coco ought to know what they's going to do, you know. Did she talk to him?
Yeah, she talked to Don.
Well, she talked to Jane yesterday morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, she talked to Don.
Well, that's who she wanted to talk to.
Yeah, because she talked to Jane. She told me she had talked to Jane.
Yeah, she did. She talked to Jane yesterday morning.
But she hadn't talked to Don.
No, she did get to talk to Don, so she wanted to talk to him. I imagine they're going on pretty early.
He said probably around noon.
What? Well, I told Coco, I said, it's just like Louise's outfit. I said, they'll never get up and get ready. She said, I bet you that's just the way it's going to be.
And, you know, it's funny because, you know, you and Cora and AW doesn't operate that way.
Oh, I don't either. Louise,
and I don't either.
Absolutely, Louise Nim can run me crazy.
If you're going to go somewhere, get up and get ready and all.
They can absolutely run me crazy. They run me so near crazy till I'll hop up and fix Warren's breakfast so he can get on out the way and stop walking. Because if you feed him, you know, he'll go on and do something. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, he won't. But that don't worry them. They used to.
Well, what does she do about going to work?
Goes to work with a cup of coffee. Gets up at 8:30. Takes a bath night before. Gets ready. Dresses. Takes a cup of coffee. Gets to work just in time. Mm-hmm. Now, Sulaine knows the one that's worrying me. Sulaine's never going to make no money going to work at no 2 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. That's all it is to that. Anybody can see that. But that's the way she wants it, you know, so she can lay up there in that bed. But she gonna have to...
How does she do that with a child?
Well, that child stay in the bed, get up and fix it a bottle and hand it to it, and it drinks its milk and goes by. I've never seen such a child in my life as it is.
Because Lynn, you know, was up before daylight.
Well, she ought to have Lynn a little while. She really should have had something just like her. Still of that, she's got something to let them sleep with her.
Because Lynn wouldn't no more put up, and you know Lynn would no more put up with that than a man in the moon.
Lord have mercy, no. She's been early riser ever since she's been.
5:30 in the morning. Well, she was
That baby will get to whining and then pop up and give it a bottle of milk and it'll drink it and throw the bottle to put her to bed and go back to sleep till 10 o'clock.
Hmm.
I've never seen nothing like it. And it's healthy as a buck. It's just healthy as it can be. Never see.
Boy, it must not be real active then.
Oh, my goodness, it's active. Yeah, it don't never stop. Just goes all the time whenever she gets it up.
Mm-hmm.
Or she'll get it up about 10 o'clock. Bathe it. Fix it. Give it its breakfast. But then she could go to work. That's when she ought to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
Then when she gets up.
Well, she
she has to do her washing and her...
Yeah, but Lord help us, old anybody. I heard Louise tell her Sunday evening if she'd bring the clothes over to her, she'd do it. Now, I had no business meddling in that. I think that was one reason Sulaine wanted to see if she could have some responsibility, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's gone fiddled up with that. I don't believe Sulaine's going to stay with Susie, but I'm scared to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to get Susie struck off on the wrong foot, but...
Louise
should... I sure did hear some things when I was there.
Louise shouldn't interfere with it. She should let her take the responsibility and do, Mom.
She certainly should, and she ought not be listening to Sulaine's tattling back and forth. They ought not talk back and forth to one another. They ought to go on just like they belong to.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Okay, I'll see you.
Good.
Bye.
Different things in different ways.
It is Economics Week. Time magazine has a cover story. The Gallup poll came out yesterday on the economy. The Harris poll is out today. And all of it means bad news for the administration, which is a story worth examining. I'll have that in a minute.
Chancellor.
Nixon entered the White House in 1969. Americans were spending about $10.70 for $10 worth of groceries at 1967 prices. They are now spending over $12 for that $10 worth of groceries. When Mr. Nixon sat down in the Oval Office, unemployment was just over 3%. Today, it has almost doubled. These twin phantoms, inflation and unemployment, have haunted the administration from the beginning. And the haunting is likely to go on for a while, no matter what the optimists in the White House say. In fact, the unemployment rate is a more stubborn enemy than the Viet Cong. Mr. Nixon is winding down the war, but as long as inflation and unemployment stay wound up, he's in deep political trouble. The Gallup poll made a survey in the middle of last month, 1,500 interviews in 300 selected communities, and discovered that for every person who thinks the Republicans can keep the country prosperous, there are two people who think the Democrats can do it better. That is a profoundly significant political fact. It affects not only Mr. Nixon, who runs again next year, but all the Republican senators, governors, congressmen, and dog catchers who will be running with him. These latest Gallup findings should move a lot of Republicans who are up for re-election next year toward some kind of action on prices and wages. Today, the Harris survey says that two out of every three people think the country is still in the throes of a recession, and that many of them are getting more pessimistic about its duration. The Harris interviewers discovered that 73% of the people they talked with give Mr. Nixon a negative rating on the economy. Time magazine says on its cover, "Stand pat or do something." From what the White House is saying, stand pat is the plan, although the president recently dropped a hint that if the Congress would come up with a workable plan, he might follow it. Some cynics said immediately that the president wants the Congress to force some controls on the country instead of doing it on his own, because controls would be unpopular. But given the public apprehension about inflation and unemployment, nobody really knows if some form of controls would be unpopular or not. What is crystal clear, however, is that Richard Nixon is faced with a political problem which could, more than Laos or Cambodia, make him a one-term president. The Democrats could lose it next year by squabbling among themselves, but it is hard to see how Mr. Nixon could win if the economy stays bad. It will be interesting to see in the months to come what he'll do about his problem. John Chancellor, NBC News, New York.
If men who shoot eagles are trying to prove something, let them do it the Hopi Indian way. Back in a minute.
Back?
Among Hopi Indians, there is a tradition. When a boy is 9 or 10, he is taken from his village to the high mountain where the eagle lives. The boy is lowered over the edge of the mountain and with his hands must reach into the nest of an eagle and capture a young bird. He takes him home, and for the summer before the bird is freed, that eagle will sit on top of his house, symbolizing that the boy therein is now a man. The white men also have a way of demonstrating manhood with eagles. They kill them.
They go up in a helicopter with a high-powered rifle and a telescopic sight and shoot eagles. The stories came out of Wyoming last week. The helicopter pilot told them 3-4 times a day, he said, he would take men up and they would shoot eagles. In 6 months, they killed more than 700 eagles. A rancher is said to have paid for it because eagles were taking his sheep. Well, it's against the law to kill eagles. So from Washington, the Interior Secretary decried this cold, callous, deliberate defiance of law. He pledged to investigate and stop it. But in fact, what was done was merely an extension of what, in other cases, the federal government encourages. For years, the government has been in the business of paying to have animals killed. It is the Predator Control Program. Bounties are paid on coyotes, bobcats, wolves, foxes. The federal government pays people to shoot them, trap them, poison them. It paid, in the last fiscal year, $3.6 million to kill animals. There are many who oppose this, some on moral grounds, some on ecological grounds. To attempt to wipe out a species of predator, they feel, is to unbalance nature. And that is not only arrogant, but dangerous. But aside from moral or ecological concerns, a strong argument can be made against the Predator Control Program on economics. Apparently, the whole program costs more money than it saves. At least, this was the testimony against the Interior Secretary when he said it often costs the government $20 to save a $10 animal. In other words, the government, it would seem, could do well to get out of the business of killing animals. And, of course, beyond that, it should make sure that men in Wyoming or elsewhere no longer go up in helicopters and shoot eagles. If such men want to prove something, let them do it. Let somebody dangle them over the edge of a mountain. Jack Perkins, NBC News, Los Angeles.
Not much.
Me either.
Hey,
uh-huh.
I'm down at work now. This guy just come in. I'm working for him.
Mm-hmm.
I know you go out to Sunland quite a bit. You got quite a few clothes.
Yeah.
And two of his children.
Uh-huh.
And can you take them out there?
Oh, sure, Ronnie.
Well,
anything. Magazines, clothes, anything at all. Records.
Okay.
Just anything.
Well, they're probably in the 14 to 16.
Oh, yes. They need those.
The boys.
Uh-huh.
He's just a little shorter, Marchand, about the same size.
Oh, well, yes, that'd be wonderful.
The boy's about the same, too.
Uh-huh. Oh, sure.
Okay, well, I told him I'd call him back.
Mm-hmm.
And,
excuse me.
When are you coming in town?
I'm supposed to take Marchand to the airport tomorrow, Ronnie. But he probably wouldn't have him in there by then, would he?
Well, what time are you going in there?
Well, her plane leaves at 3:30, but I haven't got her ticket. I just called in to reserve it. I'll probably try to be there no later than 2 or 2:30 at the latest. And then probably I might be out there from 3:30. If it's on time, I'll leave at 3:30. If not, I'll leave at 4.
I'm working.
Oh.
See, I'm working now.
Uh-huh.
You work Thursday, don't you?
Yeah, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I mean, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I'm all mixed up on my days.
You'll be in Wednesday.
Right, uh-huh.
Well, we can get it to you Wednesday, then.
Okay.
With Marchand, going up to see Jimmy?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, she's all thrilled. Yeah, they called, and they wanted her to go this week and this past weekend, and I don't know, I didn't know that, you know, that the seats were being taken so much out of here, and I called Friday and tried to get her a reservation for Sunday, and they didn't have anything till Tuesday, so she wasn't able to go. So she'll go tomorrow at 3:30.
Okay. How you been doing? Okay.
Oh, pretty good, Ronnie.
Get over that headache, okay?
Hmm?
I said, did you get over that headache?
Oh yeah, finally, yeah. He asked me how much I was working, and I told him one day a week, because I had to work the next Wednesday, and he said, well, that he was going to give me a prescription. I'm sorry.
Okay.
He told me, you know, to take it after I worked that one day, because I wouldn't be able to work, And he said it was real strong and went on with doing all this and that. And I came home and talked it over with Jim, and I told him that I wasn't going to take anything like that anymore. I'll just go ahead and get the headache. Right?
I don't know.
I just don't want to get back in that, Ronnie.
No.
That was too bad. I mean, I just don't want to do anything like that. So if I get a headache, I'll get it. I'll be all right the next day. So I'll see you tomorrow, or Wednesday, okay?
Okay.
Okay, come see us now. Now, you're working from 4 to
12,
and then when are you through?
Well, I'm off this weekend, but I'm going to run up to South Carolina.
Yeah. You won't have a chance to go to the beach now, before school. You going to go to your friends up there? Hmm?
I said, this is my last weekend before school.
Right, uh-huh. Okay, well then, will you be in there Wednesday?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll see you then, honey.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello?
Hello, Guy?
Yeah.
It's Debbie.
Hey, Debbie.
How are you?
Oh, right.
Well, that's good. Did you have a good trip? Didn't you go to the mountains?
See, had a nice trip, yeah.
Oh, she just went by herself, huh?
Uh-huh.
I see. I wondered if you were going to be around on Wednesday, if that would be convenient for me to come out.
Well, I'm sure it will be. We'll be here. We'll be here.
Okay.
Faye is out throwing the horses or something right this moment, or I'd ask her. Where are you?
Well, I'm at home. I wish I were talking to some horses.
Yeah.
But I'll see you Wednesday then.
Yeah.
Out in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Okay. I have to tell you about all the plays we saw down in Sarasota. We saw some really good ones.
Oh, my.
State Theater there.
You're just full of plays, aren't you?
Yeah, we saw five in 5 days.
Uh-huh.
So we were quite theatered up.
Yeah.
Well, I'll see you Wednesday then, okay?
Righto.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hello?
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Hi, checking in with y'all.
Suzanne's just checking in.
I called Miss Mary last night.
Yeah?
She's home from the hospital.
And she's home from the hospital.
Yeah, only she's going to stay with her Marvin's sister, I guess. Or her sister, I forgot. Does she have a sister?
I don't think so.
It must be Marvin's sister, because the doctor gave her strict orders to just sit and stare.
And she's staying with the sister?
Yeah, she said she's going to go over today and stay with her, you know, until she got a little better.
Yeah.
So I don't know where the sister lives.
Yeah. Well, I think she Marvin has a sister that lives across the pasture. That's probably the one. Across the field. But she came home. Yeah. Well, what's on your mind?
Well, I thought, you know, work on the tapes more.
Yeah.
They'd come out tomorrow.
Okay. Well, that's
unless you all need an audience or something.
Suzanne says, do we need an audience today? She's working on a tape. Well, I think that's a good idea. We can see tomorrow's Miss Daisy's day, and you go ahead and work on your tape then.
Okay.
And
I wanted to pass on a message. Mrs. David Henderson, do you know her?
Who?
Mrs. David Henderson.
Mrs.
She
Davis?
She talked to you earlier in the summer about you hearing your daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
About last.
Yeah.
Well, she said she's leaving the 21st and they won't be back till Labor Day. And she, you know, wanted to know if you'd be able to hear them by then, or if not, she'd think about getting another.
Yeah, well, I told her to do that. Yeah, well, I'll give her a call.
Okay.
And let's see now. Maybe you could check in again. I'm going to call too, but maybe you could check in again at the animal hospital.
Okay.
And you know, see what you. And I'm sure there could be 10 horses out here, considering the ones that are more than 10.
Yeah.
Just see if you can find out when they expect to be around.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Okay.
Missouri critics in Congress have increased in recent years and are girding for a new effort to cut the Pentagon's budget. But it may not be easy with unemployment up and a political campaign just ahead. Some observations in a moment. In 1960, John Kennedy campaigned far and wide on the theme this country had a missile gap and was falling behind the Russians. It was an argument that helped him win the presidency. Today, there are those who still say the U.S. is falling behind the Russians and call for greater defense spending.
The joint military chiefs are said to be seeking White House support for a $7 billion increase in spending next year. But the difference between today and 1960 is that many more people challenge the old arguments about defense needs. The critics of constantly expanding military budgets now include some congressmen who once voted for everything the Pentagon wanted. In the past 2 years, the military budget has been cut by $8.5 billion, and President Nixon has had a difficult time getting congressional endorsement for big new projects such as the Safeguard anti-missile system, which survived in the Senate by a solitary vote. In hearings being held before a Senate subcommittee this week, Democrat William Proxmire is trying to show the U.S. is spending much more than is necessary to meet any threat from Russia or Communist China. One of today's witnesses, George Rathjens of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, said the U.S. is ahead of the Soviets in every important strategic defense program, and in some instances is far ahead. He also said the U.S. continues to lead in military technology, and he disputed claims the Soviets are spending more on defense than we are. Despite this, there are two factors that may slow down the drive to contain the military budget. One is unemployment. With many defense workers already laid off in various parts of the country, there is less inclination to cut back on Pentagon contracts. Then there is the 1972 presidential campaign. It is all well and good for a candidate to say he favors getting rid of military waste and cutting back the budget where it can be cut, but none of those who figures in speculation for the Democratic nomination wants to be depicted as endangering American security. Senator Henry Jackson of Washington already is warning against the Democratic Party becoming the party of weakness if the Democrats in Congress insist on more defense reductions. So this year's campaign to trim the Pentagon budget may not be as successful as the budget cutters would like. Nonetheless, the Pentagon no longer has its way on Capitol Hill. It may get most of what it wants this year, but it will have to fight for it like every other government agency.
Perkins, NBC News.
Automakers began revealing their new cars today. There'll not be much surprise. In most cases, the 72s will be just like the 71s. Except for one thing, they'll cost more. And the consumer probably won't know why. Back in the automobile prices in this country, next year, we are told, will be up 4 to 5%. That means $100 to $200 per car. Prices have been going up for 7 years. Since 1965, the average model price has gone up $800. The consumer asked to pay this extra money has every right to ask why, but from the automobile industry, he does not get much of an answer. A spokesman for one company, asked about this fall's price increases, said they are, quote, required to recover the costs of product improvements and higher manufacturing costs. Well, that's rather vague. If many 72 models will be basically the same as 71s, there's not much product improvement to pay for. Anyway, given the record of recent years, even if there are changes, they do not mean improvements. 1969 auto bumpers used to allow expensive damage to cars, but 1970 bumpers, having been changed, allowed even more. They've been changed, but certainly not improved. Aside from paying for, quote, product improvement, the spokesman also said prices would go up to pay for higher manufacturing costs. Now, what does that mean? A major manufacturing cost, of course, is labor. Auto workers did win a new contract last fall, higher wages. But companies raised their car prices last fall to cover that. That's what they said the increases were for. They should not need more now. They raised some of their prices again last spring, when, by government edict, certain optional features were made mandatory. That has already been covered. And it's not that auto companies are losing money. General Motors' six-month profits this year, $1.2 billion. The big four companies combined earned $1.6 billion after taxes. $1.6 billion is almost 50% higher than they earned last year. Earnings up almost 50% although sales were up only 18%. This means companies are making a great deal more on each car this year than they were last year. Why, then, should car prices be raised again next year? Well, there may be a reason, but if there is, consumers are not being told. Unless the answer is the very simple one that Henry Ford gave in an interview 3 years ago. He was asked what was his company's number one problem. Henry Ford answered, "That's easy, making more money." Jack Perkins, NBC News, Los Angeles.
Morning, Faye.
Yes, Shirley.
How are you?
Fine.
Good. I'm doing a lot better this morning.
I don't know why Faye handed it to me.
Oh, how are you this morning?
Oh, I was put out with you yesterday.
Oh, why?
You sitting out there entertaining guests.
Berman gave me a fit, too, when he got home from work. I really did more damage to my knee than I thought I was going to do.
Yeah?
I shouldn't have got on it, but it set me back a little bit.
And there they were just carrying on as usual. They were trying to help you.
Yeah. I'd been in this bed for 4 days, and they thought it would do me some good, you know, if I got up and sat up and talked with them for a while, and it was. It was very resting for me to get in there and sit down for a while. So, but I put more weight on my leg coming back to the bed, and it really gave me a fit last night. So,
oh, really?
Berman blessed me out for even getting up.
Yeah.
But I'm doing a lot better this morning. Very, very, very well.
Yeah. Well, why don't you just get up and entertain?
Yeah, I feel like dancing a jig.
Yes, well, I'm pleased, Shirley.
Listen, I wanted to thank you so much for the dinner.
Well, Faye, you're the one she ought to talk to. She told me. Come on, talk to her. She's the one who said thank you.
Hello? Where'd everybody go?
Yeah, here I am.
Oh, I want to thank you so much for that dinner. I'm telling you.
Well, you know, when I think about this, six or seven or eight of you all over there.
Oh, well, you know, Mrs. Richards and them just came. They left shortly after you all did.
Oh.
They wouldn't stay for dinner. And the kids had gone in swimming, you know. And
yeah.
When they came out of swimming, they were starved. And I didn't have a thing fixed for them. And Bonnie, bless her heart, she'd been doing so much, I just didn't ask her to do any cooking. And the kids they were just out of this world. They came in, they washed their hands real quick, they sat down at the table, and they looked at that ham, and they didn't say a word.
Well, it for hungry swimmers, it should have been three or four times that size.
Oh,
I thought maybe it'd supplement something.
It really hit the spot. And that cake, Berman enjoyed that cake tremendously. He sat here last night and ate a piece of cake before he went to bed. And he said that was really good. And the kids, of course, went for the chocolate, which he does. He'd rather have the white. So you really caught everybody.
Well, that's two or three days we've been talking about getting something over there and haven't. So I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You shouldn't have gone to so much trouble,
oh,
though.
Did they find the potato salad in the refrigerator?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now then, Shirley, what's the thing that we can do the most except try to encourage you to stay in the bed?
Well, you've already done a tremendous part yesterday when you did this for us, because you caught me unprepared. I didn't have a thing fixed for them, and boy, that helped out just at the right moment. So, no, I'm doing very well this morning.
Oh?
Tell Mr. Miles, I feel like I could get up and dance a jig.
Well, you probably will.
But I want to go in now tomorrow and see what the doctor has scheduled for me, so get that out of the way. I want to find out what was causing all this trouble before it hits me again.
Yeah. Well, who does the cooking over at your house?
Well, either I'll prepare it, you know, here if I can in the bed, and then Berman will go ahead and put it on, you know.
Oh, I
here.
See.
but we like to cook the day before so we have something the next day.
I see.
And we kind of got behind, and that's why I say the food you brought over yesterday really came in.
Well, Bonnie's a pretty good cook, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. She can scramble up some eggs or boiled potatoes or...
Well, look, you take care of yourself, and we'll check in again with you.
All
and
right.
Stay in bed.
Let me ask you this, though, Faye. I've been wondering, did Berman get to see that little bull calf?
Yes, he did.
He did?
Yeah.
What did he say about it?
He thought he was nice.
He did?
Uh-huh.
Oh. I'm going to see if I can't buy him from y'all.
Guy said for you to get well, because you had to help him sell his calves.
Oh.
You were such a good salesman.
Oh, my. Well,
and I don't know anybody else like you that can get that calf sold.
Oh,
I really don't.
Well, I'd be glad to help him if he wants me to. But tell him tell him to hold on to that little bull calf for me, though.
Well, he's beautiful.
I'd love to get a hold of him.
He gets more beautiful every day. Well, you get well so you can come see him.
Okie doke.
All right. We're glad to see you. Bye-bye.
Duke, NBC News. President Nixon's trip to communist China is not only causing a reassessment of American policy toward China, but is producing assertions that U.S. leaders misled the public about the nature and goals of Peking, with the Vietnam War one of the tragic consequences. Some observations in a moment. The country recently has gone through a bitter period of self-examination growing out of the publication of the secret Pentagon papers on the Vietnam War. The documents were seized upon by critics as proof Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and other U.S. officials deceived the public about plans to widen America's involvement. Today, three China experts suggested before a Senate subcommittee that Americans also were deceived about communist China, that for more than 20 years our Asian policy has been based on misconceptions, that it was these misconceptions that drew the U.S. into the Vietnam War. By perpetuating the specter of an aggressive China ready to leap on her neighbors, U.S. policymakers were able to mobilize public support for intervention in Vietnam. The witnesses were John Fairbank, director of Harvard's Asian Center and perhaps the foremost American scholar on Chinese relations, Jerome Cohen of Harvard Law School, and Alan Whiting of the University of Michigan. As they see it, American policy toward China has been formed with an appalling disregard for Chinese tradition. Any serious study, they suggested, is enough to show that China has been principally concerned with her own defense, that while many other countries have established far-flung colonies, China has never even tried to establish colonies in Southeast Asia. One of the problems, Fairbank argued, is that Americans have been raised on the idea of expansionism. It is normal for us to think of having a million troops overseas, but the Chinese have no such tradition. Fairbank said it's also a myth to regard China as a great power armed to the teeth, that it's unlikely she'll ever have the kind of large-scale nuclear weapons programs that exist in Russia and the U.S. He also suggested the Chinese army is no model of superiority. Fairbank said the American public may possess as much firepower as the entire Chinese army. The experts also advanced the theory the U.S. has encouraged the Chinese belligerents of recent years by taking actions designed in some cases to deliberately provoke Zhou Enlai's government. As one example, they cited support for espionage activities on the mainland by Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government on Taipei. The violent reactions these triggered from Zhou were then used by U.S. policymakers as justification for expanding the American role in Asia. Understandably, the historians applaud President Nixon's efforts to normalize relations with China and to shape a new policy based more on reality than mythology. Paul Duke, NBC News, Washington.
California, the days of the golden boom are over. Back in a minute. For two decades, California has been the land of golden growth. Men's dreams were to be found here, sunlit, cellophane wrapped, 10% down, and low easy payments.
Men's dreams were to be found here, and men came in search of them. And for two decades, it was boom. Somebody was always reporting with great discovery that every day 1,000 new citizens were crossing the border into California, that each week 7,000 were coming, pale and searching. California not only had a boom, but was proud of it. Those were days of tremulous boosterism. California wanted, most of all, to be first. First in population, as it believed itself to be first in lifestyle in this country. It was a Californian who wrote the quatrain, "Look upon the fact, my friend, with joy or pain or sorrow, but what California is today, the rest will be tomorrow." A Californian wrote that, and Californians believed it. California, in those years, was the leader in many things. Lest we forget, it was California that gave us topless dancers, freeways, smog, Carol Chessman, Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Snoopy and Peanuts, bottomless dancers, pictures on checks, Dr. Seuss and the Grinch, helicopter traffic reports, hippies, the X-15, Howard Hughes, paintings of children with big eyes, the Black Panthers, dune buggies, and Disneyland. California gave us all this. For better or worse, California was a leader, and people came to it. It became the largest state in this country, and it continued to grow, particularly Southern California, and people wondered, when would it stop? Well, it has stopped. The boom is over. The latest figures are startling. They show that more people in this past year, more people left Southern California than came to it. Los Angeles lost people. There were enough births barely to make up for it. But the point is that the migration today is not to Southern California anymore, but away from it. People are moving away from the cellophane and the smog, the nude dancers and the freeways, the uncertainties of the earthquake, the certainties of the taxes. People are leaving this. The age of California's golden growth is ended. Men's dreams, most men seem to feel, must be somewhere else. Jack Perkins, NBC News, Los Angeles.
Hello?
Hello, Guy?
Yeah. It's gone on the blink.
Yeah, the clutch just kind of collapsed. And it's parked over there in front of Graham's Hall on campus.
Well, that's too bad. What are you going to do with transportation?
Well, we'll have a call down to the transportation place tomorrow and get the things done. Probably won't take more than a couple of days.
Yeah. Gosh, Peter, is that going to be costly?
Probably. It usually is, but...
Yeah.
It kind of depends if it, if they look at it and it doesn't look like there's too much to do, Jim might be able to do it. But, you know, he doesn't have the tools up here, so we'll probably just have to press the jump.
And that's the clutch?
Yeah, the clutch. It, you know, if you pushed it in, it wouldn't come back out. It just some kind of spring or something broke. Kind of pressure line, pressure plate.
Yeah. He pushes the clutch in.
Yeah, well, you see, it's been acting just a little bit funny. So we push it in and come back out about halfway. And it just started that today, or just noticed it today.
Yeah.
And then when he drove to the campus this afternoon, he pushed it in, you know, changed gears, and it didn't come back out.
So it's sitting over there.